Hi, this is Ollie Allen here with the Oral History Summer School of 2026. We are in Hudson, New York, and I am here today with Armando Estrada. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Hello, my name is Armando Estrada. I'm here in Hudson, New York with Ollie, and we are with the Oral History Summer School.
Excited to speak with you today.
Thank you.
Can we get started with, would you mind telling me a little bit about you growing up?
Of course. I was born in San Antonio, Texas. I was born there. In summers, I would go down to Laredo to visit my grandmother and then to Mexico City as well. We would cross the borders often for shopping, and this was the summer times, obviously, and I would come back and go to school in San Antonio. My mother is from San Antonio, and so is all her family. And, I went through school there. I went to school there until the end of third grade. I loved it. I love San Antonio. I love everything about it. Whenever I'd leave town with my dad, whenever we'd drive back into town, he'd kind of wake me up. If we were coming back into the city at night, he'd wake me up and kind of like, hey, look, you'd see the signs of San Antonio and like the tower, which is our downtown huge tower. So I always got this feeling when I returned to the city, kind of like home, you know? So yeah, my childhood was spent a lot in San Antonio. And when I was at the end of third grade, let me just go back a little bit. When I turned six, I had a little brother named David. He was born, and I remember going to see him at the hospital after he was born, and my grandmother told me that she's like, you know, this is your responsibility now. Like, this, you have to take care of this guy for the rest of your life. This is like, you're the big brother. And, like, I remember that so vividly. And I was only six, right? And I'm like, what? Like, such a big concept to be responsible for somebody. But, I mean, I took that role. And, I mean, that's my little partner. And, you know, I would, like, he was always with me. And I was always, you know, teaching him things and being with him and protecting him and, like, wiping his butt when he needed it. I was six whenever he was born. Fast forward a little bit more when my parents had gotten, they didn't get divorced, but they had separated, and my dad wanted to take us up north. He had a brother that lived in Wisconsin at that time, so he was going to come up, go up there and work. And so he brought me and my brother to Chicago and then to southern Wisconsin, or mid Wisconsin, sorry. And so when I went to Wisconsin, I was at the end, so I left the third grade here in San Antonio. When I got there, I took placement tests, and I didn't go to fourth grade. I went straight to fifth grade, which was cool. But also, I had some older cousins that were in fifth grade, and they were kind of like, hating on me because I passed up my cousin that's exactly my age, and I went to fifth grade. And that was cool. I know fifth grade was fifth grade was kind of crazy because, like, I moved to the Midwest, and the town that I live in, I was like the only Mexican. That was like a big culture change and shock, and I experienced some racism, but I never really kind of like got upset with it. I thought, you know, I've always been kind of like a positive person, and you know, just didn't let it really bother me. I went to sixth grade, and that's when I really realized, like, the age difference between me and a lot of my peers, right? So, like, they were all, like, 1.5 to 2 years older than me. So, like, just that whole middle school experience was kind of crazy, just being that much younger than everybody. But overall, great experience. I met a lot of cool people. I have a lot of longtime friends from Wisconsin that I still talk to this day. I mean, some I even consider them my brothers. When I got to 10th grade, my dad's youngest sister was in Colorado Springs, and her husband had gotten deployed to Iraq, and she had two young kids. So she asked me if I wanted to come and experience Colorado. if I could come and, like, go to school, and then, like, she would work at night, so if I could watch the kids during the week at night. I'm like, heck yeah, she was my aunt, and I loved hanging out with her. And so then I go to Colorado Springs, 10th grade till the end of school, till the end of high school. And wow, like, Colorado Springs, like, first when you get there, it's like the whole city is based around a mountain, Pikes Peak. And everywhere you go around the city, like, you'll know where you're at in relation to the mountain. And such a, like, a, I don't know, when I first saw the mountain, it kind of, like, gave me this, like, connection to it, you know, like, I felt connected to it. And, like, I've always been really kind of connected to land and gardening and stuff like that through my grandmother, but there was something so powerful that about that mountain that I just felt it within my heart, just, like, it pulled me towards it. So I loved Colorado, like, it was amazing, and I still go back often to visit. I try to go at least a couple times a year. Colorado's a beautiful state. Denver, Boulder. But yeah, I mean, my childhood is that in a nutshell, and a lot of traveling, you know, like, I was fortunate enough to travel around all the states, the United States, and of course Mexico. And I thank my dad so much for that, because, like, traveling so much, experiencing different cultures, foods, it opens up your world, and it gets you prepared for an open-minded journey in this world.
Yeah. You've spoken very fondly about Texas and Colorado and Wisconsin. Can you speak a little more on your time in Mexico?
Yeah, for sure. So in the summers, you know, I'd look forward to go to visit my grandparents, you know. So I'll tell you, some of my earliest memories, my grandparents were building a ranch in Laredo, which is south of Texas. So there's Laredo and there's Nuevo Laredo, which is right across the border, and that's Mexico, right? So my grandparents were building a ranch there. And at first, you know, complete land. I mean, like, we call it monte, right? But it's, like, just all land. And one of my first jobs was digging the outhouse hole, right? So I must have been, like, 5 or 6 at this time. But I'm out there with a shovel digging a hole that's going to be eventually our bathroom outside. So I'd look forward to these times, you know, like, being out in the complete, like, just being out, going from city to, like, ranch life is scary at night because there's so dark, but, like, also so, like, unlimited possibilities of exploration. At this time, my dad had got me, like, a moped, so I was driving this moped, like, all through the ranch, just getting, like, crazy. But I'd come every summer, I'd look forward to it. The food is one of the best things ever. Like, when I got to the ranch, I remember eating rattlesnake, like, some our neighbors cooking rattlesnake, rabbits, and of course, like, pozole, enchiladas, a lot of cooking out. Like, we had fajitas and brisket. But one of my favorite things that my grandfather would cook, and I remember specifically, like, on my birthday, or my birthday, or my aunt's birthday, is, like, he would make mollejas. And mollejas are cow glands, and they look like brains when they're raw, right? And a long time ago, like, these were parts of the cow that I guess people would, like, throw away or wouldn't eat, so they'd be, like, very cheap, but we'd have tons of them, and they were so good. As an adult, I started seeing these at restaurants, these cow glands, mollejas, but they're referred to as sweetbread. And in France, they're actually a delicacy. So there was it was reintroduced to them as an adult, and now they're, like, a delicacy, crazy expensive, right? I mean, not too crazy, but more expensive than they used to be back in the day whenever people weren't really eating them. But that was one of my favorite parts of, like, being down at the ranch, eating mollejas. And I hope you can experience it someday because they're so tasty. They taste like butter, and, like, you butterfly them. They look like brains, like I told you, but, like, on the grill, they have a distinct smell. Some people swear they will never try them, but they are so good. Another one of my favorite things is, like, I was really into music. I've always been into music, drawn to music, and when I was young, like, I had a tape player, like a Walkman tape player, and, like, I'd get all the new rap, all the new, like, Mexican music, and I'd have, like, a stack of just, like, all kinds of music. So when I would come from the city to Mexico, I would bring all these tapes for my cousins and friends, and they would also look forward to it because I'd be like DJing for them like at 7, 8 years old. And one of my favorite experiences was one time I was playing a Fresh Prince tape with Will Smith, right? Fresh Prince. And it my tape player ate the tape. And I was like, oh, I didn't know. I was crushed. I didn't know what to do. So I rewound the tape into the tape to where it would kind of like roll back in. And I noticed where it had kind of like got eaten, right? So this little part, you couldn't do anything with it anymore. So I had this idea that maybe if I cut that up and put a little scotch tape on it, maybe it could play. And it did. But that one piece was now missing from the song, right? So I learned how to splice audio straight up through tape on the ranch in Mexico. And from that point on, like, I started thinking, okay, well, if I can do that with this part, maybe I can cut a little bit of this tape and bring it and combine it with another tape. So I was making mixtapes before I even learned how to record mixtapes, right? I was, like, slicing and taping. And I thought that was crazy. I mean, this is what I loved about, you know, kind of like being out in the ranch. Like, you've got plenty of time to figure out the things that you want to figure out. And that's one of my most memorable experiences of being in Mexico. But also kind of like crossing the border. Like, it was so easy to cross the border back then. This was like 1989. We'd go back and forth freely. Since on the ranch, like, we didn't have running water at that time, so like everybody in the ranch everywhere in there would have water tanks, right? And these water tanks would kind of like would hook up to piping to have like an outdoor shower, and of course connected to the inside, or eventually we got a toilet in the inside, right? And so we had all these plumbing things all coming from this water tank. So one of the things I look forward to is crossing into the United States to fill up these water tanks, right? Because it'd be like a journey, like a little adventure. My grandfather would put the water tank in the back of his truck. We'd cross the border, fill it up, go get burgers, you know, kind of like do that, and then come back. And also that's such a fond memory of just the adventure to get water. And, you know, like, we take it for granted in the States, like, you know, we have running water, cold, hot water, you know, like all that good stuff. And when we wanted to take a bath, let's say, like, during the winter, it wouldn't get too cold, but, like, during the winter, we'd want to take a warm bath, and my grandmother would heat the water on pots on the stove and put it in, like, a little makeshift bathtub, and we'd kind of, like, me and my brother would throw ourselves in there, and the best time ever, like, it'd be so fun. You know, I would love to, you know, revisit those times. I think it was one of my favorite memories as a child. But I'll fast forward to 2020 because these moments that I'm telling you inspired me to buy my own land. But I bought the land north of San Antonio in this place called Bandera, right, which means flag. But Bandera is a completely, like, you know, like, it's like the cowboy capital of the world is their motto. So you see a lot of, like, white people, but there's some Mexicans out there that have bought land next to me. And so I started doing that. Like, I got it during COVID, so 2020, I was taking my son out there, and when I bought the land, it was completely filled with trees. You couldn't barely walk through it, which is why I think I got a great deal on it. Every weekend, my son and I would go out there and start cutting trees, and, like, you know, it was such a little, like, bonding experience for him and I as well, to kind of, like, go cut trees, spend a day doing work, and he'd be so tired. Like, and I remember, like, he was a peckish eater, and after the first day that we worked, I took him to a restaurant in, like, downtown Bandera, and he ate his whole plate, like a 3-egg omelet. Like, I've never seen him eat like this before, but it's because he, like, worked. So, you know, like, re-experiencing, like, the land and, like, you know, cultivating the land. And we did it all by hand, right? Like, I bought a bunch of tools, but nothing, like, mechanical. So we were cutting trees. Well, I guess the chainsaw is mechanical. We were cutting trees on the weekends. I made, like, a path that goes, that first we could drive in, finally, after, like, probably 2 months of cutting trees, we could drive in. And I wanted to keep, like, the, like the nature of the land. So I only carved out like three other spaces where we could put tents at. And other than that, like it's completely like foresty. And I love it like that. Like I've quoted like to get like plumbing done over in there. And it's just not an investment that I really can justify doing at this moment. And also I don't really care because I also bought a water tank, not as big as the one that we had in Mexico, but enough to like go for a weekend, maybe weeks at a time visits. But no, a lot of inspiration comes from Mexico, from what I eat, our language, the land cultivating, gardening. Yeah, so much inspiration from Mexico.
Yeah. That land that you began cultivating with your son, what has it turned into?
So I've thought different. It's still as it is. Like I have three campsites on it, but what I did was I put it on Airbnb as primitive campsites, right? So when I'm not using it, and well, Texas gets very hot first of all. So like in the middle of summer, like I don't get any hits, but like fall and spring, yeah, people will like rent the campsites there because it's like completely like primitive camping. And yeah, so it's like it's a chance for me to kind of like make some money off of it. And you know, like it's I use it as a like our vacation spot for the most part. I use it to go have Easter cookouts, you know, like bring my family out there to hang out and experience it. And yeah, I mean, just for that, sometimes during the week, so it's about 55 minutes away from my house in San Antonio. So sometimes if it's a really nice day outside, I'll take like 2-hour lunch and I'll drive out there and just eat lunch and hang out and just like put the hammock up and just take it all in. You know, I love nature and I love like recharging in nature and like listening to birds and like the sound of the leaves when they're on windy days. So yeah, so it's there and I've thought about like building on it and I will eventually, but right now if I build a house on it right now, my taxes will go up like substantially. But if I put like a shipping container on it, something that's a movable home, the taxes will not go up. So I've toyed with the idea of bringing a shipping container, putting it out there, like kind of welding like a door, windows, and you know, like a little, just like a little something to kind of like keep my barbecue grill in and stuff like that, you know, so I don't have to like haul stuff back and forth. So that idea I'm toying with, but other than that, it's there. It's there for whenever, you know, my family has an RV, they want to go hang out there, like go do it, you know. It's like it's for all of us, it's for anybody that wants to use it. Now that I purchased that land, I really want to invest in land that's off the river, like off the river or lake, right? Because like I have a huge love for water, and I need to be like I remember thinking, and I still will do this, but like I think when I retire, I want to like have like canoe rental on my lake or something like that, right? Just kind of like grab like 10 canoes and just like wake up every day and drink coffee by the lake and have visitors, you know, utilize the space. And yeah, I think that'd be a kind of a cool way to live my older life.
Sounds really interesting. If I can round back, you've mentioned your family a lot. Can I ask about your relationship with your son?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, man. My son. So my son was born when I was 27. And I'll give you a little context. Like, I grew up with a lot of cousins, right? And a lot of younger cousins. So I always knew that I wanted to have kids. I thought, people would ask me sometimes, like, how many kids I want. And I'm like, I want 10 kids. You know, obviously that's crazy. That's a crazy idea. But, no, like I wanted it. I was ready for it. So yeah, when I had my son, it was like the best thing ever. Like the day that he was going to be induced, like, so he passed his due date, right? He didn't want to come out. He was just chilling. So we had to get him induced. And on that day, you know, him, his mother and I went to the hospital and I had bought a video camera specifically for this moment. So I'm in the delivery room and I hear the doctor saying, okay, Dad, no video cameras, only pictures. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. I completely filmed everything. Like I went in and like I have it all on film So it was an exciting moment. Like, I have that filmed. 2 days later, we're taking him home. I have it filmed that, you know, putting him in the car, narrating, like, the whole drive home. It was seriously one of the best moments of my life. Super sweetheart. Julian is his name. And, yeah, I mean, like, every year of his life was just beautiful. And him seeing my characteristics in him, like seeing like kind of like mannerisms that I've seen myself do in the mirror, was a crazy thing to me, like mind blowing even. And then seeing his mother's mannerisms coming out in him, it's like, how can these things pass on to our kids? But like, what? It's science. It's crazy. Like, it blows my mind to this day. So, yeah, I mean, like, so, you know, obviously, like, the whole toddler years were beautiful, and I remember, like, coming home from work, and I hear him upstairs say, his mom would say, "Dad's home," and I hear, like, the little pitter-patter, him running downstairs, like, saying, "Dad," and, like, oh, man, it was such a beautiful feeling. So, yeah, toddler years, and then school starts, you know, and, I have every first day of school picture, except for the COVID year, right? Because we didn't take them to school that. And I think I still did a picture just to keep it, you know, like on tradition. But nah, like, it was important for me to be there on every first day of school, because, you know, I wanted to like be around all of his experience. I think that my dad was with my brother and I the same kind of way. My dad worked a lot more though, so he wasn't able to kind of like be at our like first days of school or whatever, but for me, I have made it a point to, like, be there and, you know, and do this all the time. And, yeah, so, like, we have a super tight relationship and, you know, we tell each other we love each other still to this day, like, almost every day. And, yeah, like, recently he just finished his first year of university. And that was kind of, I mean, that was different and fun and, you know, him living in a dorm room, I think that I love seeing him grow and, like, be responsible. And he's always such a great head on his shoulders. You know, I'm heavily in music. And whenever his first grade years, I was teaching piano at this culture center in San Antonio. So every Wednesday, he'd be with me, like, teaching, like, 10 kids in one room to play piano, and every one of those kids had a piano, right? So it was loud and it was crazy, but we made it happen. And so he was, you know, he's introduced to music theory early on in life. You know, he knew how the keys, scales worked. And then middle school came around, and he joined the choir group, so he was singing choir. so cute. And then he got into a trumpet. He did trumpet for a little bit. He did cello during middle school. And in ninth grade, when he was entering ninth grade, he told me that he's like, "Hey, Dad, I'm not going to do any music this year." And I was like, "What?" And he's like, "I'm going to take Japanese instead." And I'm like, "Oh, okay, sure. Maybe it's like a little fad or something he wants to do because he watched anime or whatever." You know, I didn't think anything of it. Well, this little guy, he ends up excelling in Japanese. Junior year, goes to Japan in the summer, like, speaks fluent Japanese, like, completely blows my mind, as he always does. And I thought that was awesome. But also, like, around this time too, he starts doing some, like, electronic music stuff, so I knew he was coming back to music. And I knew that he was soaking in all that stuff from, you know, piano classes and stuff, like, back in the day. So he now makes electronic music on the side, and super impressive. Like, he does, like, modulations and stuff that I would never think that he would have known, but, like, he does it by ear, which I never did. I can't do music by ear. Like, I can't listen to a song and, like, go and immediately play it, but he can. You know, he knows exactly where to go on the piano, and I think that's so, so dope. But since we're talking about Julian, when he was, 14, I had a daughter named Vera, and so it's like, you know, going from, like, all this huge gap, and so he's, like, he's about to turn 19 in June, and she's 4 and a half, so yeah, 15-year gap is insane, right? Like, just like kind of like re-experiencing fatherhood in that sense has been like beautiful, and like the dynamics between both of them is completely different, you know. Like she's very independent. She wants to do everything on her own, and she won't let me cut her food, or like she wants to do everything. She wants to cook, she wants to clean, she wants to sweep, like just do her things, you know. And I love it. I think she's so awesome. And the way she kind of like shows me love is a little different than my son. My son's like very loving, you know. Both of them are very loving and sweet, but she's kind of like has the more kind of like a bossiness of like, you know, like come cuddle with me and stuff like that. And I think it's so sweet. I think it's awesome, and I love the way my son his relationship with my daughter. Right now, I almost said my brother, right? Because this is another funny thing. When my son was born, and I still to this day, I will call my son my brother's name, and I will call my brother my son's name. And I don't know, it's because I think I told you earlier about my grandmother telling me I'm responsible for my brother, and like I had to take that responsibility. And they look alike, and they have, you know, they do look alike. And yeah, it's so weird that I kind of get them, not confused, right, but that I go back and forth calling them each other's name, because I feel the same way about both of them. And I'm responsible for them, and I have so much love for them. And yeah, so I've always thought that's kind of funny, because like I catch myself calling them that, and like, why am I doing this? But now, yeah, I think that I have a great relationship with my son, love him so much, and my daughter as well, my brother. I think that very lucky to have all of them in my life.
Could you maybe say some similarities and differences between your and your brother's relationship and your son's and daughter's relationship to each other?
Yeah. Well, the gap is a huge difference, right? There's only a 6-year gap between my brother and I, but there's a 15-year gap with Julian and Vera, my daughter and my son. My son has taken that role kind of like of the responsible older brother, and he takes it so well. And like I said, he's very loving and like always kind of like, you know, we just went to the carnival recently, and he's just like very kind of like protective of her and like making sure she's, you know, just making sure she's taken care of in all kinds of ways, whether she's hungry or, you know, like just always looking out for her. And just naturally he's got that, like, I don't know, it just happened, and he had it. And I think that's how I am with my brother as well. My brother became a father shortly after, like honestly, like 3 months after I became a father, right? So, you know, he has 3 kids, a daughter and 2 sons. And honestly, when I saw him turn into a father, like he went into this huge responsible, like he was kind of wilding out for a minute, like just like going crazy, and like not crazy, but like, you know, it's like living a risk-free life, you know, just like doing, you know, whatever. And when he, you know, found out he's gonna be a father, like boom, like a complete change in him that he totally took the role on. And I think that like I saw him I saw a new chapter of him becoming like a person, a responsible person. I was gonna say a man, but what? No, like a responsible person, right? Like a person that looks out for, you know, his children and stuff. And I think that was something that beautiful that I saw in him. So we come from a huge loving family, and I think that we try to show love always, you know. And I think my brother has it, my son has it, my daughter has it. Like, we are completely, like, welcoming people, right? Like, whenever we have family coming into town, I want to cook a bunch of food and just, like, make sure we, you know, everybody's taken care of. And I think we got that from my dad, honestly. Like, my dad was always kind of, like, cooking for the family. And when we'd have family coming in from out of town, he's like, let's make a bunch of food so that way they have something less to worry about when they get here, you know. Let's make it a home for them, like a hospitality, right? Like showing crazy hospitality. So I think that we all, my brother, my son, daughter, we're always thinking of others for sure. You know, and I think it's an important, thing to have to ensure, you know, just great things. I think that being, hospitable and being kind gets you a lot further in this world than the opposite.
How have you seen those characteristics play out outside your family, like maybe in your community?
Heavily involved in my community. And I will tell you, when I was 14, my first job was at a pizza place in Wisconsin, like a family-owned pizza place. It was kind of crazy, like seeing the dynamic between the families working there. But like, you know, I got the job and I wanted to make money. And so I got into the hospitality, but you know, like working there at the pizza place. And then I started, when I graduated high school, I was working as a bartender, like at 18 years old. I think that everyone should at least work some waiter, bartender, cook job in their life. I think that it gives us so much like skills to be in the real world, right? Because like learning hospitality is, like I said, important. So yeah, I use hospitality in community. I use it in work. I think that creating a space where you make others feel welcome is important, because like if we have this skill, I think that it builds relationships, it sustains relationships. And don't get me wrong, there's been relationships that have fizzled or whatever in my life, but I don't, you know, that doesn't have to do with like hospitality stuff. It's just like two people on different journeys. But I like to come with, you know, like that kind of like welcoming way of life, kind of like I was gonna say, like, not a serving way of life, right? Because like just to kind of like make sure that when people are in your community or in your vicinity, you want to make sure that they're comfortable. Like, why not? Like, I want people to feel comfortable around me. I think that whenever you make people feel comfortable, you bring out better conversations and better relationships. And these things won't always be reciprocated. And I think maybe that sentence alone maybe sometimes kind of like hurt my heart. Like, when you make time and a space for people to feel comfortable, and you want it, you want that to be reciprocated, but you know, it's just not always the case. So I think if I've ever been disappointed in life, or like kind of like my heart hurt, has been when, you know, maybe it's not coming back like that. And I know we shouldn't expect to give love and expect it to come back, but you can hope for it, and you can hope that humanity is that. But again, like I think I said earlier, I'm just like a positive person, and I think that I still will always give this like 100% creating spaces for people to feel welcome. I think that, you know, like I've always approached everybody I meet with the same level of respect and love, you know, no matter who it is, no matter like race, anybody, like class, race, none of that matters to me. It's like it's humanity that's at my, like, it's at, that humanity is in my scope of vision. And you know, like I think that, which is why I think that everybody should work at least sometime as a server, because shoot, you meet, whenever you're in the serving world, you'll meet some people that are just mean and like, and like demanding, and then you're like, wow, like how can you be like that? But it teaches you how to deal with these types of people that you'll meet in later on in life, in work, you know, or in life, like in just regular life. So I think that those are skills that you learn in these types of hospitality jobs that help you kind of like maybe not get so disappointed or hurt whenever you come across people that aren't so nice. And yeah.
Can you tell me about an experience where you've had a demanding person?
In a job?
Sure, yeah. Or in life.
Yeah, I mean, I could tell you both, like, in jobs, like, you learn to see, and I don't want to say you learn to read people, because sometimes people can surprise you, right? But you do see patterns in people that are more takers than givers, right? And like, yeah, and it's just like it's such a weird place to be in. And maybe like at the first, when I first started encountering people that would be kind of like demanding in, as far as like in the server world or bartending world, you'd be kind of like, what the hell? Like, well, why, what, like, what do I do with this? But then you start to kind of like shrug it off and be like, well, you know, maybe they had a bad day. And you start thinking of things like that, kind of like you start learning empathy. And to learn empathy, you put yourself in other shoes and you say, hey, maybe they're not having a great day, or maybe they have been treated like poop, you know, in their life where they now project that. So I think that that's a hella important skill to learn empathy. And that's helped with my relationships as well. Yeah, but, you know, like it's helped in relationships because, yeah, we don't know what the person, a person that you encounter on the street is dealing with, or why they could be acting a certain way. So I think that it's taught me not to judge people and not to reciprocate hate or rudeness, you know, things like that. Sometimes I'll respond to rudeness with a laugh, and maybe that's not the best way to do it, right? Because, like, I know that can irritate somebody as well. So I try to control my facial expressions, but at the end of the day, it's like I can't let negative energy kind of like both make me give back negative energy and also kind of like make me not, I don't want to like laugh at it, or, you know, I want to be empathetic. I want to kind of like, hey, like, you know, just kind of like turn the other cheek, for the lack of better words. So yeah, no, I mean experiences all over the place. Like I've gotten, you know, like rude people, take like sending food back that they said that they didn't order, but they actually did, you know. Like I've always been very, my memory is like super good, and I would write down things as well. So it's like some people would just be rude for the heck of it, and I have no idea why. I won't even pretend to know why. But I had to learn that it's more about the person being rude than it is about me. And that's a hard thing to kind of like really grasp, you know. It's like I would go home a lot of the times and ask myself how I could have done something different to not get that reaction. And you have to tell yourself, like, it's not always you. You just gotta, like, be empathetic. So I didn't give you specific examples because there are too many out there to pick from. But, you know, like, I'm trying to think if I've ever been met with any kind of, like, physical things. But I know there's been times where, like, it could have gotten physical with people just, like, kind of, and this is more so when I was bartending, right? Because when alcohol gets involved and rude people are drinking, then it's, like, a whole different thing, right? But, you know, I've been fortunate enough to not really encounter anything too crazy that happened to myself or whatever. You know, I've seen people, like, you know, I've seen people get in fights in front of me or, like, you know, like crazy stuff like that, but never, thankfully, to me.
If I can stay on the line of work experiences, you mentioned your passion for music earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, music is an outlet for sure. Like, music is therapy, music is joy, music is sadness, and that sadness also is therapy, you know. Like, there will be some times where I can listen to a happy song and I'll cry from it, right? But also, I'll feel better after doing it. Whenever I was in college playing, you know, performing music, we would perform this thing called jury, right? Like, at the end of every semester, we had to perform a piece that we had been working on the whole semester. And I've never seen anybody, like, break down like I've seen break down on jury days. Like, I've seen people quit music programs. I've seen people throw up, cry, leave the stage. Because we have to play these jury pieces in front of all the music majors, right? So it's crazy intimidating, nerve-wracking. And, I mean, And also, like, there's a thing where music drives me to tears often. Like, there's been times where I've played a piece and I'll start crying, like, and, like, not hyperventilating, but close to it, right? Kind of just, like, that cry, that exhilarating feeling. So I learned that, you know, I learned that I'd much rather be in the production side, right, in, like, composition side as opposed to performing, right? Like, when I DJ, I can perform because I can put my headphones on and, like, run that stuff, right? But, like, when you're playing music in real time, you know, with no headphones on and you're performing, it's a whole different monster. It's like, you have all eyes on you. And it's just like these pieces that I'd play sometimes just would like make me cry. Like I'd just be tears coming out of my eyes in a great way. Right. It feels good. But like just to be doing that and in front of people, it's like, oh my God, like, what am I doing? So when I finished college, I was still bartending at this place in San Antonio, called Liberty Bar, which was like super cool. I love it. It's like such a dope place to be. But there was a woman that approached me asking if I could come and fill in for a piano teacher that had stopped coming to the lessons or whatever. And I never thought of myself to be a teacher, right? Much less a piano teacher. But I was like, okay, you know, I'll do it. She offered me some money, and I'm like, cool, yeah, I'll do it. And I went to that class, and I, you know, had some things prepared, and I played with the students, and wow, I wasn't expecting to fall in love the way I did. Like, I remember this kid named Lisandro. I think he was like 8 years old, didn't speak any English, right, but was in this community center because it was on the west side of San Antonio, and his dad knew that he had, like, this music in him, and I played him a piece, and he played it right back to me, not knowing anything, not knowing how to read music, nothing, just, like, by watching my pattern, and literally, like, he played it right to me. I'm getting tingles telling you this because it blew my mind. So then I stayed there for 10 years teaching piano to these kids that would come through every semester, right? Just like a whole new group of like, you know, like marginalized kids in the area that, you know, these programs were free for students. They were free and then they started costing like $10 a semester, you know, like, because, I mean, it's a nonprofit organization that is still there doing its thing. So I'd have kids come in there first. Not only kids, like there was kids and like adults that would come through this program. Like sometimes, I remember this one guy, he was like 50 years old that came through, and the way he'd play piano, he'd play it so rigid and like just like go really hard at it. And that was a challenge for sure. But, you know, he made it to, at the end of every semester, I also had them performing a piece, right, in front of people. So he made it to his performance piece, and that was it. You know, I got him there, and that's, I was like, cool. But the kids that I would see that would just pick up music taught me that music is a language. Music is something that's inside of us. Like, if you listen to your heartbeat right now, it's going in a pattern, and it's going on time. It can go faster and it can go slower depending on what mood you're in, but it's always going to keep that time, a consistent time. And it has to say something about our connection to music. It has to be like internal, physical, biological. I don't know, man. Like, there's no really explanation. But sometimes I tell people that music is both math and science. It's patterns, it's chord progressions, and it's like, the further you, it's tension, and that's where the science comes in. Like, you're hearing these songs and you're creating tension, and then you get resolve, and resolve brings you home. Like, it brings you home, and it's like every song that you hear always has a resolve. It has a tension and a resolve, and like, that's humanity too. Like, how much tension do we go through in life, and we try to find resolve, right? We try to go back home and feel comfortable. And same thing with music. Like, you'll hear this like intricate piece, but you'll come back home to the beginning of the key, and like, you feel it inside of you. You feel that home kind of like chord. It's like, ah, moment, you know? And that's why I love music. Like, I love like just like the composition, the science, the math, music theory. And whenever I, my first music theory class in college, half the class was out by a month into the semester because it's difficult. I mean, it's not for the easy. It's not for, It's not an easy subject, but, you know, going, once you get past one, two, and three, and four are get even more difficult, but you start understanding the math and science to it. And you start seeing these pieces that, like, Beethoven wrote and, like, a Mozart, you know, and, like, how these pieces that were written ages ago, you can hear now on pop radio. You'll just hear shortened versions of them and, like, little excerpts. But, like, a lot of music that was written in the early days of notation is, a lot of those things are still happening in music. Just, again, like, just in shorter increments. But it's a language. I think music is another language. Like, my daughter, when my daughter was singing before she spoke, and she was singing Barney, right? Like, and it was so cute. It was so cute. But, like, she was singing, like, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, like, at 1.5 years old. Like, it was insane. But, again, it just proved to me that music is inside of us. And some people can let it out easier than others. Some people, like, got it. And some people have to work a little harder at it. But it's still accessible. And that's why practice is very important when you're trying to learn an instrument or, yeah, trying to do anything with music as far as your own creativity. It takes work. It's one of my music professors told me one time that musicians and doctors go to school for the same amount of time and the same amount of difficulty. And I was like, what? No, like, music can't, like, you can't save or you know, that you can't save a life with music, but maybe you can. I think I've saved my own life several times because of music, or definitely gotten myself out of sad moments because of music, you know? So yeah, I think music's it's another language, and it's inside of us all.
If you're comfortable, could you expand on what you mean by music got you out of those tough points?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, just like, you know, like any kind of breakups, you know, or like, I'll tell you, whenever I was leaving Colorado, right, like after high school, I remember my aunt was going to drive me to Texas, and just like, I was about to leave the city, and like, I'm obviously feeling emotional because I'm leaving behind, I want to go back to Texas, and my mother is there, and this song comes on the radio. It's Cher singing Do You Believe in Life After Love? And just like that, I start pouring tears, you know, both in a way that I know in this moment right here, I'm leaving my high school life behind and I'm going on my journey of adulthood. And it's just like, boom, in that moment, this song is making me both cry for yearning for a life that I'm about to leave, and also seeing a life that I'm about to live. So that's one key moment that popped in my head right now. But like, you know, like sometimes I will, you know, like a friend of mine had passed during COVID, you know, like 2 years younger than me. And like every song that we ever listened together, like I was listening to that for the next year, and like, and going for runs and just like crying and like listening to these songs over and over. There were songs that I would listen to the same song like 50 times in a row, and it could be like a happy song for the most part, but like, just because you experience this song with a person late at night, you know, drinking, and like this person is no longer on this earth, like, you know, you want to like kind of like resurrect this person in any way you can. And music does that. Music can take you to a specific moment in your life when you experience something both sad or extremely happy. So music is like a time machine, you know. And so are scents, right? Like smells are also time machines, I believe, but we can talk about that some other time. Music is a time machine. It can take you to an exact moment in life when you first heard a song, or when you experienced a song in something like maybe traumatic or happy happened in your life. One day my son was like 3 years old, and we're listening to the radio, and Tom Petty's song comes on. It's a Tom Petty song, and I can't remember it right now, but I look in the rearview mirror, and my son has tears coming out of his eyes. I'm like, what's wrong? He's like, I don't know. And he's like, he's listening. It's clearly the song that's affecting him in this way. So Yeah, like music, are time warps, and so one specific song I told you about my friend that had passed away, Marcos is his name. There's a song by the California Honey Drops called "All Day, All Night," and it's a song about like a guy and a girl breaking up, but like him and I listen to this, like it's a bluesy song, and we listen to it, you know, when we're going through our own breakups, and I could not stop listening to that song, and like it completely reminds me of him now, you know, like it's taken on a new reason to listen to, I suppose, or you know, it's a song about, again, a relationship breaking up, but to me it's a song about him and I listening to it as we reflected on our own relationships breaking up. But yeah, if you can search that song, if you like the bluesy stuff, you should listen to that song. It's so good. But no, I think that there are times I have a go-to song. It's called from this group, this guy from Austin called Neon Indian, and he has a song called "If I Knew I Would Tell You," and it's 30-second song. It's like synths. It's 30 seconds. But anytime that I feel any kind of sadness, I'll put that song on, and like immediately I'm like back, you know, like I'm happy, and I'm like, okay, it's not that serious, you know, like it just brings me to a good place. Another like 45-second song called "Her Majesty" by the Beatles. Wow, it's like, again, 30 to 45 seconds long, so short but so powerful. Like, this is why I love about music, again, like kind of like you can listen to a 7-minute song like "No Woman, No Cry" by Bob Marley, or you can listen to like a 45-second song by the Beatles that just kind of like puts things in perspective sometimes. And the fact that music can do that, it's, again, powerful. So yeah, those are some specific times that I gave you there. Trying to think of so the Tom Petty song is called "Free Fallin'." That's the one that made my son cry. It was so cute. Oh man. And I still bring it up to him, and he remembers it. Like, I think he was like 4 years old, but he remembers me, like he remembers me asking him why he's crying, and he's like, "I don't know." But you know, and such a like in the song "Free Fallin'," like, I mean, the words are like kind of, you have to be like older to comprehend these meanings, but it's not only the words that get you, it's the tension and release in songs that kind of like bring you to a internal, just some internal things.
Where did you go or move musically after your position as the piano teacher?
I remember the last, it was during Christmas when we did our Christmas, like, festival or whatever. I had, you know, like, my son was already, I think my son was in middle school at that time. And I had gotten a lot of approaches to do private lessons. And honestly, like, private lessons was where it's at. Like, you know, I could do teaching out of my own home. I could do teaching that wasn't restricted by anything, right? So I can do like piano lessons, I could do electronic music lessons. Remember I told you I started going into more production stuff, so I was wanting to record my own things, and I started learning really like kind of like sound recording technology, like audio levels and like how to record live bands and just kind of like the sound, like sound engineering, right? So I wanted to go more towards that. And by doing private lessons, I was able to open it up, right? Kind of like, I didn't have to stick to just piano. We could use piano to learn how to compose, right? Because when you're sitting at the piano, you have the bass that you play with your left-hand side, and you have the tenor that you play with your right-hand side. And within the piano, you can have four people in a band, right? You have a bass player, a guitar player, even a drums, right? You can do percussion with a piano. So I wanted to think of music in a bigger way and not limit myself to just doing concert piano pieces, because again, I told you, like, sometimes like these pieces would like kind of like make me cry and like get me in some internal things. And by doing production, I allowed myself to be able to teach these things to students that really wanted to be in it, right? Another thing with teaching music in a community center is that you get 8 out of 10 students that are there because their parents want them to be, and they do not want to be at all. So some of these kids, you know, I felt like I didn't want to force them to learn a piece when they didn't want to. I've seen kids cry in front of me that I know wouldn't have cried because of what I'm doing there with them. It's because their parents are, you know, forcing them to learn something maybe that they wanted to learn in their life, right? Again, projections and stuff like that. We're crazy as humans. But when I started getting into private lessons, I had students with intention. And that was important to me after this time because, again, like, I don't want to be I don't want to be a waster of time, right? I want things to be done with intention. And whenever you do things with intention, the outcome is far more rewarding both for the teacher and the student, you know? And you get kids or adults that I would teach that wanted to be there, right? That were looking forward to being there, that would go home and practice, right? Because that's an important thing. When I would see these students once a week, we'd be learning the same thing over and over again because they didn't practice. When I started doing private lessons, I'd get students that practiced, and like I've seen them like succeed and grow older as musicians and now play like in bands and you know, have utilized the tools that we learned together I don't want to say accomplish something, but to like fulfill themselves with something that they wanted to learn. And also, whenever doing private lessons, like I always said to myself that I'm practicing. Like, I'm teaching, but I'm practicing for myself. Like, I'm doing my own fulfillment. I'm learning from these things as well, you know? And there were students that would come in and would teach me things because they would see something different than I wouldn't see in this specific piece. Or they'd take it to a different place that I would have taken it to. So it's like that whole dynamic of, like, doing private lessons, I loved. Yeah, I loved it. Really, really loved it. Then I started doing like other work with like radio and like my productions, I started getting sought after for production and for like audio engineering, and I got more interested in like in radio because of conversation, right? Like human conversation. But whenever I'm recording like interviews and stuff like that, I can go home and write a quick piano piece to give color to these interviews, right? So I was still able to use all my music knowledge, but go even deeper into like human connection. And then I found a love of like journalism and like interviewing and storytelling and like learning people's lives through ancestors and like journeys, and like that kind of moved me in a different way as well. And so I found that it was more fulfilling to me in that moment to kind of like get these stories out, because they come to me in it, right? And like with these powerful stories that they wanted to get out of themselves, and I could be a vessel for people that would, you know, come and interview with me and talk. And like I'd go to open mics and I'd record open mics and like kind of put it out there on the radio. And you know, I think that was important to me at this moment in life, was to kind of like, again, be a vessel of like of storytelling, bringing storytellers to audiences. And so I think that it's all been kind of like a journey of learning for myself, learning how music and storytelling can work together. And yeah, I mean, that's where I went. Yeah, I went from group lessons to private lessons to radio to oral histories.
Considering all that you've said and that end note on oral histories, what has brought you to Hudson?
So I was in doing this community radio last year, I mean, I've been doing it for like 4 years now at this specific station. And there's an artist, a local artist in San Antonio named Mark Menjivar. And he got in contact with me about some things that he was doing. He invited me to his studio, and he has like an organized library of recorded sounds and interviews. And I was so impressed by this kind of like, it looked like a doctor's office, such a, like a clean, organized white room with audio files and tape recorders and stuff like that. And he told me about this program in Hudson called Oral History Summer School. And he's like, yeah, man, like you should look into it. And, you know, the alumni are filled with like journalists and just like people who come to a place and speak about ideas and like goals and like things like that, right? Like I love to be in conversation with people who, with ideas and goals and like know what they want to do, right? Like it's something more, it's just a beautiful thing, right? To see these types of things. So anyways, I looked into the Oral History Summer School. Him and I worked together to kind of like get me up here, and I ended up getting a grant that paid for my tuition and for me to come up here. And holy moly, like I get here, and honestly, the first day I'm already like, yeah, this is where I'm supposed to be. This is it. You know, like I told you, I was doing a lot of journalism and like storytelling, recording interviews, editing interviews to kind of like bring out little excerpts, you know, kind of to make a story out of a recorded audio. But we get here, and I'm like, I start listening to some of these oral histories that are kind of, you know, long form. And maybe it's not all, maybe you don't hear like moments to where you're like kind of drawn in, but you stick around and then you do hear these moments and it builds like organically. And I was completely blown. Like by day three, I'm like, I'm in love. I'm in love with this stuff. And so, yeah, I mean, like not only everything that we were learning, but being in a cohort of like-minded people that also wanted to learn these things with intention, right? Like everybody was here had intention to learn oral histories and to be completely in it. And to be in a city with a cohort for 12 days straight, right? Like no breaks, just boom, 12 days straight. You're with a cohort of people that are wanting to learn, and you're with a group of people that are teaching these things. And you almost kind of like, I mean, if it's in you, it comes out, and like it comes out, and like you just want to be a part of everything oral history. You wanna conduct these. You wanna hear people's stories in depth, and you wanna like really like dig in. And that's what brought me to Hudson. You know, like I fell in love with the city of Hudson. I fell in love with the cohort. I fell in love with oral history. And as soon as I got back home, you know, like I knew I wanted to practice this. And this is the approach that I've taken with everything now. Now when I do interviews, I no longer want to edit interviews. I no longer want to bring the shiny parts of an interview out for, you know, for whatever, kind of to get attention or anything like that, right? Like I want to record an organic conversation that builds and takes little hills and you know, like goes in and up and out and you just never know where it's going to go. And also, like, the power of a question. I never thought so deeply of the power of a question and how to be intentional with a question, right? Because when you're intentional with a question, so much can happen. So, yeah, that's what brought me to Hudson. And I believe that it was meant to be.
If you can imagine yourself 10 years from now, what is a piece of advice or a phrase that you would like to remember?
Hungry listening. I think that one of the most wonderful things about oral history is that your listening is so important, right? Like, and what I mean, it's not only important here in oral histories, listening is important in human conversations, in relationships, in learning. Like, to be an intentional listener is like watering plants, right? It's like, that's how we grow. That's how we grow within each other. That's how we grow further in life. Like, that's how we obtain knowledge. Like, it is a... I think that to be a great listener, to listen with intention, to listen to learn and not to listen to reply is one of the most important things that I've, that I'm, in 10 years, I would, you know, like, I still want to be doing that, right? I want to be a listener. I want to be a great listener. I want to respect every human being that I'm around, every animal that I'm around. I want to listen. I want to listen and to learn. I want to listen to grow. Yeah. Listen to grow.
Thank you.
Thank you.